Hey y'all, I'm Suzanne Little and I'm an alcoholic. And if y'all think that I look like a frustrated country music singer, you're right, I am one. I've always loved things that are sparkly and flashy, and I made a really good I guess a barroom drunk. I just, you know, give me some strobe lights and some smoke machines and I'm happy. So I want to thank you guys for having, this is the nicest place. This is my first time to be here, and the committee has been so wonderful, and the food was fantastic tonight. I can't wait to see what tomorrow is going to be like, so thank you very much. My sobriety date is October the 9th of 1989, and I'm going to tell y'all in a very general way what I used to be like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. And I am, my home address is Fulton, but we actually go to meetings in Tupelo, Mississippi. And my home group is the Sunrisers group. And if y'all are ever in the Tupelo area and want to hit a meeting, we would love to have you. I guess if y'all can't tell, I'm a country girl. And I live in Itawamba County. That's in North Mississippi. That's where I grew up. I was actually born in Huntsville, Alabama, Dirk. And my dad worked for NASA over there. And all of my life, I've been a misfit, until I got to y'all, where I fit in. And, it seems like before I got to AA, I spent my whole life feeling like my skin just didn't fit right. And one of the things I love about speaker meetings is it doesn't matter how old the speaker is or whether they're male, female, black, white, it just doesn't matter. You know, we get up here and we share how we were bent fenders and we took a drink. And I love that because that's what happened to me. You know, the big book talks about fear causing as much trouble as stealing, that it should be classed with stealing. And that's been my experience so far. I can remember being a kid and just being scared to death of everything. And I really had no good reason to be. You know, I come from a good family. We didn't have a whole lot of money, but my parents are real good people. And I always felt like I didn't fit in. And I can remember my mother being told by some lady that I went to this daycare thing, and she told my mother, I guess I was 5 or 6 years old, that I was going to have problems fitting in to society. And she was right, I did. I had some issues with society. When I was, I guess, about 8 years old, we moved to Mississippi from Huntsville, and I started riding a county school bus, and I went from a very urban sort of environment to the middle of nowhere, and it was a big adjustment for me. But I think the biggest thing was that I did not know what to do with my feelings. You know, all of my life, I've never known what to do with how I was feeling. And I can remember riding that school bus, and I'd just be scared to look at somebody. You know, I was just scared to death of people in general. And there was a boy on that school bus, and he would mess with the girls, and he was just, you know, just a total jerk. And he was messing with me one day, and I just was so afraid. And I reared my fist back, and I punched him as hard as I could in the face. And I was in 7th grade at that time, and he was in 9th grade. And, you know, that was one of those miracles that happened to me. One of them was discovering booze. But I discovered something that day. I made that boy cry, and I bloodied his nose. And I got in trouble. But it was worth it because I learned a really valuable lesson that day. And that was, if I can bluff you and make you think that I'm tough, you know, and scare you first, then you won't be able to hurt me. And it worked. You know, I will never forget that feeling of power that I got from hitting that boy. And that tells you a lot about the kind of drunk I was. But, you know, I spent my life doing that. You know, I've always been the kind of drunk. When I started drinking, I was never a lover. I was always a fighter. So, you know, it wasn't a good idea to take me out on a date and give me a fifth because you were in trouble. But, you know, I took my first drink at 14, and I was at a pastor party. And for those of you that are not familiar, Robert, I don't know if y'all have pastor parties in Atlanta. I'm sure in sobriety you don't have those now. But that is where you are out in the middle of nowhere, and there's a bonfire, and you're drinking and probably listening to Hank Williams Jr. and, you know, just having a good time. And it's God's country where I came from, I'm telling you. But I can remember taking that drink at 14, and I went from being awkward and scared of the boys and afraid to say anything, scared for you to look at me, to just, I mean, I turned into Tina Turner. You know, it was a miracle. And I discovered booze. And I had never figured out what the big deal was about alcohol. You know, I had a granddaddy that was just a terrible drunk, and he would say he was going for a pack of cigarettes, and we wouldn't see him for 3 weeks. You know, it was just, you know, he'd be gone. And I never saw him when he was really, really bad, because by the time I came along, he was kind of settled in, and he'd drink that gin and just kind of be a quiet drunk. But I had heard stories about him running around the house in his underwear, shooting at the neighbors, and just, you know, really just cutting up bad. And I can remember when, I don't know whether it was Thanksgiving or some holiday, we were having a family dinner, and his head just fell into a big bowl of mashed potatoes, you know. And everybody just kind of picked him up and wiped his face off and carted him off, and it was just, we never talked about him. You know, we just never discussed the fact that Papa was a drunk. And so I never equated what he did with my drinking. I mean, it was just two totally different things. And the night that I took that drink at that pastor party, my world just kind of, everything shifted for me. And I went from thinking that I didn't have a good place on this earth, and from thinking that the most, you know, the happiest that I could get would be from reading a book and pretending I was somebody else, because I was always pretending I was somebody else. I went from that shy, screwed up kid to thinking, I have arrived. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. And so at 14, I went from being very, very quiet and shy and all this stuff to just, I mean, I drank as much as I could and as often as I could. And, you know, I have not so far had a legal drink. Knock on wood. Let's hope I don't. You know, I got sober when I was 20, and this was a big deal. You know, I can't imagine, you know, I'm 39 years old now, and what my poor parents must have, I mean, they had no way of dealing with somebody like me. You know, my dad is one of the finest men that you will ever meet. And I, besides my husband, I do not know of a finer person on this earth. And he worked his way through school, through college. He worked my aunt's way through college. And he is as self-effacing and as humble a man as you'll ever meet. And he's a hard worker. He's all about things like morals and building character and, you know, all that crap. It's just like, whatever. You know, I wasn't into building character. You know, that was not my thing. And if my life had not been on the line, I can promise you I would not be trying to build character today. If my life did not depend on me trying, you know, no. And my mother is the same way. I mean, these are good people. And they taught me how to live right. And I wish I could tell you that I am motivated to live right, but I'm not motivated. You know, my natural state is, you know, give me a fifth of whiskey and give me a funny cigarette and put some Lynyrd Skynyrd in, and that's what I'm interested in. You know, that's what I'm interested in. And so they didn't know what to do with me. I mean, they really didn't know what to do with me. I started wrecking cars, and I started coming in late. I have totaled two cars. One of them wasn't mine. My nose has been broken three times, and I have not been to jail yet. And another knock on wood. And I got sober and did a lot of my drinking while you could still cry your way out of a DUI. And that is it's a wonderful thing. I don't know if you can still do that or not. Some guy told me you could, because he did it. And I was like, I used to have a good buddy of mine that was he played football for Mississippi State, and we dated a little bit. And we had to stop dating after I saw him cry his way out of a DUI, and I was like, oh, no, we can't. It's all right for me to do it, but, you know, you men aren't supposed to do stuff like that. But I, you know, my drinking was, I was basically a juvenile delinquent. You know, if I went to a party, I stole stuff from people, and I shoplifted a lot and did stuff like that, and just stupid things. And I think the thing that bothers me when I get up and do one of these things is not the stuff I did when I was drinking, because, you know, we all do crazy things when we're drinking. The thing that bothers me about the person that I was before I got sober was the things that I did when I wasn't drunk or when I wasn't taking something to change the way I felt. Because by nature, I was an extremely selfish person. I was a tornado roaring through the lives of others. And I didn't care. I can remember my parents trying to talk to me about the way I was living. And it wasn't that I did not listen. And it wasn't that I just did not care. It was like the wind blowing. I didn't hear it. I didn't want to hear it. I wasn't interested in it. And they were not important enough to merit my attention. And if I came upon you and you had something I wanted and I couldn't charm my way into getting it from you, I would take it from you. And if you didn't give it to me, I might cuss you out for no reason. And that's the kind of drunk I was. And I didn't have to be drunk to do those things. And I lost a lot of friendships, and I hurt a lot of people because of the way that I acted. And I didn't have to have anything in me to be acting that way. And I guess, I drank for 6 years, and from the moment I started drinking, I was a blackout drinker. I weighed around 118 pounds, and I could drink a half a case of beer, a fifth of whiskey. I had just a huge tolerance for alcohol. And I might get sick a little bit, but, you know, that's not always unattractive, is it? I couldn't understand why some people were turned off by the way I drank. Hard to imagine. By the last year of my drinking, I had gotten into some trouble. They had this great thing at the school that I went to state, and I had a scholarship to go to a junior college in my hometown where I went to school, and I didn't want to go there. And my dad allowed me to go to Mississippi State, provided that I made good grades and kept up my end of the bargain. Well, that didn't work out. I left Mississippi State. When I got sober, I had a 1.6 GPA. I was an English major. It was really hard stuff. And I was kind of like that John Belushi character, you know, 7 years of college down the toilet. That was me. And the biggest thing, I think, that last year of my drinking was that even I had to admit that I was out of hand. I had borrowed money from the college. You know, they had this great thing where if you just walk in and say, I need money for books because I don't have any money, they'll just give it to you. I don't know what those people are doing, but it was a really great thing. And so I did that twice before they caught on that I wasn't going to pay it back. And I got caught doing that, and I had wrecked some cars, like I said, and just stupid stuff. But my drinking had gone from me drinking on Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, maybe Monday night, just kind of trying to slide back into the week, you know, to drinking I would drink every day. And I didn't consider what I was doing as drinking alcoholically. I mean, when you wake up at 9 in the morning, you need something to take that, you know. So, I mean, if you shotgun a couple of Miller Lights and take a handful of Tylenol, that to me is not alcoholism, you know. And I would do those things, and I was smoking those funny cigarettes nonstop. And I can remember the year before I quit drinking, we had this alcohol awareness deal at the school where I went. And there was a woman that came, and she spoke about her alcoholism. And it was irritating to me that I was forced to attend this, but I had to go. And I can remember sitting there resenting the fact that she was taking time away from me going out. But then I kind of got into what she was saying. You know, there were some things that stuck with me. Even though she was a lot older than me, she was 50 years old when she started drinking, and she had grown kids, and she was a widow, and there was all this stuff that she talked about that I could not relate to at all. But I can remember her talking about her feelings and the things that happened to her and how they made her feel. And there was one thing that I will never forget as long as I live, and it was this woman talking about her alcoholism and how it had brought her to a point where she was standing in her kitchen eating a ham, one of those hams with the bone in it, in her hands like an animal, and the degradation that she felt living like that. And that resonated with me. I mean, I could not get that out of my head. And I went up to her afterwards, and I told her that I had a family member that had a problem with alcohol. Which is true. I mean, I have a lot of family members that are drunks. So it wasn't like I was lying. And so I talked to her, you know, and I left, and I went and got wasted and did my thing. And by this time, you know, another year rolls around, and it's Alcohol Awareness Week again. And, you know, that comes around. It's just like Christmas. It's just always coming. And so we had another speaker, and this time I was in a lot of trouble because I had borrowed money from somebody. I had also stolen a bag of some illegal stuff. And so I had to lay low for a couple of weeks because it was a great big old bag. And of course, I didn't have any of it left when they discovered it was gone because it had been smoked away. And so I was having to lay low about that, and I had borrowed some more money from some folks that were looking for me, and my hair was dyed purple at this time for some unknown reason. I was as addicted to hair coloring as I was alcohol. It's a good thing my sponsor wasn't a hairdresser. I'd have been really in trouble. But I was running all over the place with purple hair. And so anyway, it was, you know, things were not good for me. And this other alcohol awareness speaker showed up, and he was talking about stuff. And, you know, my life was a lot different at this point in time than it was a year prior, because by this point I wasn't bathing on a regular basis. Nobody wanted to drink with me. All of my friends, because I had a bad habit of pulling knives and stuff and wanting to fight when I was drinking. And so I was having to go to this joint in downtown Starkville where all the businessmen would hang out. And they, you know, we did not mix. It was just like, I can't even describe it. I would walk in and they would all just look at me. Nobody wanted to talk to me because I looked very unkempt. And I hadn't gone to class in I don't know how long. And there was a lot of talk going on about me, and it was deserved. There were some people that were worried about me. I had gotten to the point where I would, hear things. I can remember waking up one night thinking something was sitting on the bed talking to me like a monster or a demon or something, and my phone was tapped and all this crap, and none of that was really happening. It was just that I was a walking chemistry experiment, and you know, I had not had I don't know how I managed to not kill myself or somebody else in a car, you know, because I would get in the car and drive all the time. And I thought about suicide nonstop, and I didn't have the guts to do it. And I can remember the last time that I really kind of interacted with my parents about my drinking. I had shown up, because I would go home and see them every couple of months, even though I just was going to school like 50 miles away. I went home, and because I was constantly bouncing checks. And I would bounce these checks, and I didn't have the money to bail myself out, but I expected them to bail me out, even though I hadn't done a thing for them, shown them any kind of respect or courtesy or nothing. But I expected them to bail me out, and I'm sure that's part of why I had been summoned to come home. And I can remember I showed up, and I stayed for about an hour, and I was leaving, and my dad was on a tractor working on a Saturday. And I stopped the car and told him I was going back to school. And I can remember him getting off that tractor and taking his baseball cap off and trying to talk to me. He had on a John Deere baseball cap. And he looked at me and he said, "Suzanne, what is wrong with you? Tell me what is wrong with you and let me help you." And he had tears coming down his face. And I'd seen my dad cry one other time. And that was it. That was when his father had passed away, and he was crying because of me. And I wish that I could tell y'all that at that point in time that I felt some remorse or I felt guilt or shame for the way I was living, but I would be lying to you if I did, because I didn't feel a thing. All I felt was, I wish you would get off my back. That's all I felt. You know, somebody else in my way. And I got in my car, and I drove back to Starkville, Mississippi, and I kept doing the same thing. And if it had not been for the fact that I started feeling extreme pain and wanting to kill myself, because it was always all about me, I wouldn't be here today. You know, it was not because of the people that loved me that I'm here. It was because I couldn't stand. I was at that jumping off place that the big book talks about. And I could not imagine going on the way I was living, and I couldn't imagine stopping. And so I wound up talking to somebody on October the 9th of 1989 about my drinking. And I had had a big drunk the night before. And my drinking had got to the point where I might drink a fifth of whiskey and not feel a thing and be just as sober as I am right now. And I might have two drinks and I'd be passed out. I mean, I just never knew what was going to happen to me. But it had quit giving me that feeling. You know, I wasn't getting that feeling of peace and ease that comes with that first drink. It was nowhere. And so I started going to AA, and I hated AA. I was not one of those people that walked in and felt the love of the fellowship. I mean, I would show up, and y'all got to remember now, I had like orange hair at this point in time. It was no longer purple, it was bozo orange, and Charles will tell you that it was. And, you know, I would show, it was like, what a bunch of losers. Now, here I am, my nose has been broken three times. There is somebody looking for me because I owe them money, and my hair is bright orange, but I'm, you know, thinking that AA is a bunch of losers. And I would sit there, and I would just be miserable. I'd lay my head down on the table, and I would cry. You know, I was 20 years old. Everybody was old. The only fun people that were going to meetings, my sponsor would not let me talk to because they were still smoking those funny cigarettes, and she said, you can't hang out with them. And my sponsor was the lady that I had heard talking the year before about eating that ham in her kitchen. I had asked her to be my sponsor, which was a big mistake because that woman is a big book Nazi. I'm not kidding, y'all. But I would go to meetings and I would just be, you know, I'd just be miserable. And the funny thing was that I would drive 30 minutes away because I didn't want anybody to know I was in AA. You know, I mean, I had run through campus at one point as classes were getting out and everybody was going to their next class. My hair was bright burgundy at this point, Charles. And somebody was chasing me. One of the chefs in the cafeteria was chasing me because I'd bummed money off him and hadn't paid him back. If I ever start drinking again and I ask you for money, do not loan it to me, okay? I'm just telling you. But I would go to meetings, and I was just miserable. You know, I was so miserable, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to live, and I just wasn't sure about anything. I was so unhappy. And something about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous kept me coming back. Even though I hated the slogans, the whole easy does it, and all of that crap, I just hated all the slogans. But I would sit there, and I would look at the people in those meetings, and they weren't driving cars that were all torn up, and they weren't miserable looking, and nobody was hounding them for money, and most of them had jobs. The ones that didn't have jobs were the group I wasn't allowed to talk to, you know. And so I would go, and it was so hard. I mean, it is so much harder to get sober than it is to stay sober. It is so much harder. And I would sit there, and they would talk about the steps, and Patsy, my sponsor, would, you know, she would absolutely refuse to listen to my crap. She wouldn't. I mean, she just didn't care. And I did not understand why. Every time I would talk to her about the fact that I didn't have a job and, you know, my parents weren't fronting me anymore and, you know, I was having this problem, well, let's look at the book. And she would pull this book open and she would open it up and start talking about the steps. And she had this big light because Patsy has macular degeneration, and even then her eyesight was bad. And she'd pull that big light down, and she'd open that big book up, and she'd start reading to me about God. And I would think, that's not going to work for me. You know, I've already tried that, and it doesn't work, because I was brought up in the church, and that just didn't take for me, you know. I mean, I wanted to feel something special when I sat in church, but I was always busy thinking about what I was going to wear that night or, you know, who I had a date with. Or I was always very social. And so I just didn't feel that magic that I would see, you know, that somebody felt. You know, they felt it sometimes, but I didn't feel it. And so I did not think God was going to work for me. And the biggest thing that scared me was the fact that that seemed to be what everybody was talking about when it came to their sobriety, was this higher power stuff. And I knew that me getting sober, I didn't think I was going to feel anything. I didn't think I would have an opinion about anything. I had not drawn a sober breath. And I had never gotten over, I had never grown up. And so Patsy would talk to me about these steps and about God, and I would be so afraid. And I just knew it wasn't going to work for me. And I remember doing, you know, we talked about one and two, and we did step three. And we got on our knees together, and we did step three. And I said that prayer, and I didn't feel anything. I really didn't. I was still scared, and I was still nervous, and I was not sure I wanted to be sober. I just didn't know anything. And I got to my step four, and I was nervous about that because I just didn't think that Patsy was going to understand or accept some of the things that I knew I was going to have to share if I was going to do a good step four. And I did one step four, and it was kind of like, what happened to me? And it was really not my fault, and I was just sort of at the wrong place at the wrong time, and da 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 da. And she made me go back and redo that. She said, honey, I don't know what you think this is. And she's got one of those New Orleans accents. And she said, honey, I don't know what you think this is, but this is not a fourth step. And so I had to go back and redo it. And I remember the weekend that I worked on that step four, the real step four. And I had this overwhelming sense of fear that I was going to tell this woman with her pretty house and her pretty stuff and her grandkids running around and her good life, and she was going to look at me and she was going to say, get out, because I don't want you in my house. Because I had some stuff that I said I would never tell anybody. And I did my fourth step, and I went to her and I did my fifth step, and I didn't leave anything out. But I sat there, and I can remember thinking, this is it. She's going to tell me to leave. Just like some of those bartenders said, get out, you know, don't come back. And she didn't do that. I remember sharing one really big thing and sitting there just, oh, I was so scared. And she shared something about her. And that is when I realized, maybe this will work. Maybe there's some hope for me. Maybe there's some hope for me. And that is when I realized that this thing might work. And I did the rest of my step five with her, and my gosh, that was such a blessing. I have never had such a feeling. It wasn't like the world shifted again, but it was such a sense of relief to know that you guys were not. Because, you know, looking at y'all tonight, you look like you could be sitting in the Baptist church. You know, you look good. Now, I know that you were like me, and you didn't look like that when you got here. But I was scared. I mean, I really was. And I started doing the rest of those steps. And I, you know, of course, I'm like everybody. I did six and seven. I thought, oh, no problem. And 19 years later, I'm still like, what the heck? You know, I'm still struggling with those character defects. But I did my amends list, you know, and I remember talking to Patsy about some of my amends. And I made an amends to my dad. And because at this point in time, the relationship with my family was basically non-existent. I mean, it just was not there. I would go home. I was living in I got a job making minimum wage. I was living in just basically a hellhole. And there was a prostitute that lived across the hall from me, and then a drug dealer that lived downstairs. And he was very good because he would share things with me. Like if he knocked off a Pepsi truck or whatever, he would, you know, give me some chips or Pepsis or whatever. And every so often the cops would come and get him, and I was always locking my keys in my car, and he had all the tools to help me get in that. He was just very helpful. And the relationship with my parents was bad. And when I would go home, my dad would get up and leave. He would leave the room. We didn't speak. And I had made an amend to him because I owed him some money. And I had done a lot of really, really tacky things to these two wonderful people that did not deserve it. I mean, my parents, and I know a lot of people have bad childhoods. I did not. I had two wonderful people that raised me. And I made that amend to him, and he said, Suzanne, I'm so sick of you saying I'm sorry. Sorry's not going to cut it. And that was basically the only interaction we had for about 3 years. And I would go home for holidays and stay for a couple hours and leave. But these were people that got Christmas presents from me, purchased at Be Quick with bad checks. I mean, these were not people that I showed any love or respect to at all. And I did not deserve their forgiveness. And they gave it anyway. And as far as their trust went, I had to earn it back. And it was hard, but that's what had to happen because I did not deserve to be trusted. I was not trustworthy at all. And so I was working this job and I was going to meetings and I was really trying hard to stay sober. And I can't tell you when all this stuff changed, but it was a period of time that I had been doing 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis for a while. And things started changing for me. About 3 years sober, I started getting a little bit better job so I could make some money and support myself. Not eat, you know, macaroni and cheese 28 days out of the month. And I got married. Charles and I got married. And my parents, we started having a better relationship because they had seen that I was sober and I'd paid some money back to them and I was living right, trying to do right. You know, I have never been somebody that, you know, I'm not going to exercise and I don't really like to diet because if it doesn't work after 2 days, then what's the point, you know? I don't get it. But this is the only thing that I've ever done, and I can do this, you know, because there are people sitting in here that nobody else has ever been able to get me but a bunch of drunks. And I'm active in my church today. If you can believe that, there is a place that allows me to go and worship, and I think that's wonderful. They let me go. And I really enjoy that, but it's not like AA, because those people don't understand me like you guys do. And I guess about 9 years ago, I'd been sober about 10 years, and I'd been sponsoring people and doing all that stuff and really enjoying AA, and I've been treasurer, and I'm treasurer for my home group now in Tupelo, and I think that's awesome because, you know, I was always so. And I'm in night school now, and I'm going to get an accounting degree next year. Isn't that funny? And I have a 3.16 GPA. Yay! So I had a lot of pulling up to do. I had my advisor and I sit, and we look at my transcript, and he's like, oh, well, I see it. Oh, well, never mind. You know? So he told me one time, he said, Suzanne, you had a lot of fun at Mississippi State, didn't you? I said, I sure did. It nearly killed me. But, you know, I'm doing things. My job, I've got a good job today. I've gotten to go to China twice because of my job, and that was pretty neat. I was in a place outside of Shenyang, which is in northern China, and I was driving in this car down this highway, and everything looked so strange. And I look out to my right, and there's the circle and the triangle. And I thought that was so cool. I wanted to stop so bad, but I wasn't driving, so I couldn't. But I thought, even over here, you know, there are drunk Chinese people getting sober. That is awesome. So I probably wouldn't have been able to understand anything that they said, but I thought that was so neat that I got to see that. Life is good for me today. About 10 years ago, Charles and I moved back to where I grew up, and we built a house by my mom and dad, a quarter of a mile from them. And my dad and I have lunch together every Saturday, and he's so proud of me. And I think that's one of the biggest gifts that God has given me, is the chance to make living amends to my parents. My mom and I talk every day. I go down there every morning before I go to work and have coffee with her. And one of the neatest things about that is when I got the opportunity to do that, Charles and I started talking about moving back and living near them, because he said, Suzanne, you have an opportunity to make a living amends to your parents, and I didn't get that. And I thought, my gosh, you know, that is so neat that he would be able to see that and willing, you know, to give me that. And he did, and my dad and he are very close, best friends today. Everything that I was worried about not working, it was like those doors just opened and it worked out. And so I've had an opportunity to be what I never was before I got here. You know, you guys taught me how to be a good daughter, a good sponsor, a good sponsee, a good AA member. You know, I show up when I say I'm going to be there. You know, you guys taught me that. I didn't know that. I had heard that, but I never listened because I didn't care. You know, it's when I got to AA that I learned that stuff. And it's amazing to me. It is amazing to me that I've been given this opportunity to live this life, because I never would have thought that I could have that. And, you know, when I hit my knees and pray today, I'm not afraid that I'm going to go to hell because of the things I've done. I know God loves me, and He cares about me, and He wants me to live a good life because He loves me, And I never felt that before I came here. My grandmother, when I moved back to where we live today, I got an opportunity to spend a lot of time with my grandmother, and she would have been 89 this past April. And we got to be pretty close. And she got sick in January, and she was in the hospital for 3 weeks. And during that period of time, I was able to help my mom and my aunt and my uncle take care of her, and we took turns staying with her. And she passed away, and I called my sponsor the last morning that I stayed with her in the hospital, and I told her I've never appreciated the program of Alcoholics Anonymous more than right now, because without you guys and without the program and without a God of my understanding, I wouldn't have done that. It was unpleasant and it was hard, and it was just something I wasn't going to do because it was too hard. Oh, I can't do that. Oh, I don't go to the hospital. I don't do that. You know, the program has taught me so much about being a grown-up that I never got when I was out there drinking. And if I keep coming here, you know, I see examples all the time of people that are doing that. They just come to meetings and they're living life and they're staying sober and they're doing what they have to do. And they're happy. If there is anybody here tonight that is, and I know we've got some folks that are fairly new, please don't stop. I mean, I know it is, excuse my language, but it's sucking right now. You know, probably at 3 months or 6 months or whatever it is. You know, it's so hard to get sober. But it is such a wonderful way to live. And I'm so thankful that I have been able to just, you know, suck it up and do it during the hard times. And when I come here and I see people like y'all, you know, I see the program and it's such a blessing. I mean, the people that I've met today that I've never met you guys before, but I see Alcoholics Anonymous and I see God when I see y'all, you know, and everybody's working and happy and doing 12-step work. I think it is so neat that I'm able to notice that and appreciate it today. Because 19 years ago, I just wouldn't have given a crap. I really wouldn't. This program is a gift to me. And I think if I ever take for granted what I see, like when I see people selling raffle tickets or, you know, serving tea or whatever it is, then I have missed it. You know, I have missed it. Because this is not something that I can take for granted. This is a gift. And thank you so much for giving it to me. You know, I have sponsored people that, for whatever reason, they either could not or would not take it. And, you know, you just want to shake them. You know, I've had two ladies that I sponsored that died because of this disease. And I thank God every day that as stupid and as country and as backwards and everything as I can be, I'm sober. Thank God. You know, so I don't always like getting up here and doing this. Milton, I would much rather eat food and hang out and talk, you know. But when I think about where, you know, the kind of person I was, and I know it can only just get so much better because I see people with 40 years and, you know, and I'm just like, man, it's just going to get better. I don't even have my feet wet yet. You know, God has been so good to me, but I can't ever forget this is a gift. And I thank you so much for it. You know, I thank you for allowing me to get up here and talk about the wacko nut I used to be, because I need to remember that, you know, I used to have purple hair and act like a nut and write bad checks at BeQuick. So I thank you for that.